It's not clear to me that this is simply a case of villains and heroes, or competence and incompetence, or butchers and techno freaks, or anything remotely like that.
Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, non-resident fellow at the Miller Center, and a Bulwark contributor. I'm joined by my partner in all things strategery, Elliot Cohen, professor emeritus of Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and a contributing writer to The Atlantic. Elliot, you're back from the Great White Wasteland in Canada. How was your trip?
It was fabulous. The scenery is just spectacular. We took this train that goes across the Rockies, double-decker, so the glass top. But we also spent a lot of time in a number of towns. And then we ended up in Vancouver, which was glorious. And it wrapped it all up with afternoon tea at the Empress Hotel in Victoria, which I recommend to you. One highlight was one day at Lake Louise, while I was nursing my aching knees after a hike up to a mountain tea house, somebody comes up to me and says, "Do you do a podcast?" And I listen to Shield of the Republic every week. And it turned out it was one of our devoted listeners from Palo Alto, I believe. And I apologize, I've forgotten your name, but I appreciated that. I have to say, Eric, the only downside was I return from this truly idyllic trip. And what do I encounter? A model of one of OpenAI's artificial intelligence models breaks loose and begins hacking into all kinds of companies. There's an outbreak of cyclopsoriasis, whatever that is. So that it turns out lettuce will kill you.
And, cyclospora.
And the video clip that everybody is watching is the way that orcas hunt sunfish, which it turns out one grabs it by the tail and the other hurtles into it, smashing it into hundreds of little pieces. And that did kind of make me wish I was still back in Western Canada. But here I am. So I have two pieces of jackassery. One is Donald Trump announced that he was going to impose 50% tariffs on Canada, the original rationale being all the smoke that was pouring into the East Coast after having first covered a good part of Eastern Canada, including Toronto, as a result of these wildfires in Canada, which are enormous. That this was somehow punishment for them for not taking care of their forests. Now, he's probably not aware that I believe the statistic is that the Canadian forests are seven times the size of all of our national parks combined. There is a systemic problem. It's a result of climate change, which I know this administration doesn't particularly believe in, as well as things like beetle infestations, which kill pine trees and so on. But the point is, this is a monumental problem for everybody, and there's no way humans can fix it. I mention it partly because it's so stupid, but partly because it's also a piece of what I think is Trump's genuine and deep animosity towards Mark Carney, the Canadian prime minister, who I think is a kind, even though he's not from New York, is a kind of midtown Manhattan sort of guy and represents, I suspect, everything that Trump hates and Trump has felt excluded by: Harvard, Oxford, international institutions, and so on. I have to say, it's also been reinforced by Bridge Colby, your successor as Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, kind of making snide comments about middle powers. I mean, Carney probably shouldn't have given that speech that he did, but Colby's response was genuinely juvenile. It was, I think, a sort of a pseudo-sophisticate's idea of international relations theory. That's one jackassery. The second jackassery is Zahran Mamdani giving, for those of you who are fans of George Orwell's 1984, a two-minute hate. And that was a video saying how much he wanted to arrest Bibi Netanyahu for war crimes. Now, there are a couple of things that are striking about it. There's a very good rebuttal of all this by Douglas Murray in the Free Press, who goes through the full list of lies and distortions and not even half-truths. They're more like one-tenth truths in it. But what I thought really struck me about it is, first, you know, the level of malice and malignity in it was really quite striking. This wasn't nice guy Mamdani. This is the real Mamdani, who is, in this way, and like a lot of the Democratic left these days, really possessed with a kind of hate. And it's not just of Netanyahu, it's a hate of Israel. He also, however, managed to do this on the eve of Tisha B'Av, which is the major Jewish fast, which at the moment I'm observing, which commemorates the destruction of the First Temple, the Second Temple, the expulsion of the last Jews from Spain in 1492, the fall of the Warsaw Ghetto, all which occurred on this day. It was a particularly inept piece of timing, let's just put it that way. So he also gets a jackassery award for me.
Well, as to my successor several times removed, you can say that. I can't possibly comment. Well, I would refer people to the interview he did with Ross Douthat of the New York Times, quite entertaining. As to Mamdani, you know, he engaged in something which used to drive me crazy when we were in government, and I still think is ridiculous, which is the notion that localities, you know, should have an opinion about, you know, national security. I mean, everyone, of course, is entitled to their own opinion. But, you know, the conduct of national security policy is the province of the federal government, you know, mayors, city councils. It should not be opining. You know, it's performative politics of the worst kind. And for those on the left who rightly, you know, decry the Trump's constant performative politics, you know, it's important that when the mote is in your own eye, you take note of it. My jackassery is, alas, maybe a little more momentous and serious, which is the president's tweet today, in which he tries to respond essentially to the criticism of the not yet signed, but not yet publicly made public agreement under Section 123 of the Atomic Energy Act between the U.S. Department of Energy and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia on nuclear power development for Saudi Arabia. And it's hard to know because we don't know the full text of it. The president was responding to the immediate criticisms people had that the reporting in the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, and other news outlets about this suggested that it would essentially be opening the door to uranium enrichment by Saudi Arabia without benefit of inspection by the IAEA, and in essence, open the way for friendly proliferation, if you want to call it that, by the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia at some point in the future, because they're not subject in this agreement to the so-called gold standard of these 123 agreements, which the UAE, which signed one in back in 2009, is subject to, which are limits on the ability to enrich uranium. Now, the president said, to be fair, this whole negotiation got started under Biden. Although under Biden, it was part of a broader effort to bring the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia into the Abraham Accords and lead to the full normalization of relations between Israel and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, a very worthy objective that both administrations have pursued. But the problem is, in this case, it's been done without reference to the Abraham Accords, and it does have this promise to examine uranium enrichment, and it does remove Saudi Arabia from, it doesn't have them signing the ancillary accords to the IAEA that normally go with some kind of agreement like this. So the president's tweeted out, number one, that, you know, this will only happen if Saudi Arabia joins the Abraham Accords post facto. That's not what the Saudis agreed to. And two, that they're not going to be able to enrich uranium. Well, the agreement doesn't say they can enrich uranium now, but it says they can examine with the U.S. the possibility. It clearly is opening the door to that. Why is this also terrible? Well, I think it needs to be put into its broadest historical context here. So it's not just appearing as news from nowhere to our listeners and viewers. So number one, the United States has, since the inception of the nuclear age, worked mightily to prevent other nations from getting access to nuclear weapons. Some critics have called this nuclear apartheid. And to that I, say, maybe the U.S. is guilty of that, but all in a good cause. This extended, by the way, to Britain. And in 1945, when the war ended, we cut off, even though the nuclear development of nuclear weapons was a joint U.S.-UK project during World War II, we cut them off as a matter of law from information on nuclear weapons. Britain had to develop its nuclear weapons on its own and only tested its first one, I believe. You'll correct me on this, Elliot, but I think it was 52 when they tested their first nuclear weapon. We did not want France to become a nuclear weapons power. We tried to prevent that in the 50s. So this has got, long-standing policy. It's what one scholar has called strategies of inhibition that the U.S. has pursued, keeping other countries from getting nuclear weapons. So this is a long-standing part of U.S. policy. Why was that? Well, in part, it's because people who worked in the early days on nuclear deterrence and nuclear strategy, including my predecessor several times removed as Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, Freddie Clay and Bernard Brody and some of the other great names, in the late 1950s at RAND, discovered what they called the Nth country problem, which was, it's kind of understandable how you could have a nuclear standoff, a stable deterrence between two nuclear powers. But once you enter other powers into this, three powers, much less 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, this becomes a much less stable proposition, because how countries react to one another is unclear in certain circumstances. This was something that Secretary of Defense McNamara explained to President Kennedy in a memo that built on this RAND paper, the Nth country problem. And it led President Kennedy at one point, when asked about 6 months before he was tragically assassinated at a press conference, what was the thing that kept him up at night the most? And this was in the wake of the Cuban Missile Crisis. He said, my biggest fear is that at the end of the decade, that would have been 1970, we will have 9, 10, 20 nuclear powers, 30 maybe. And in fact, we're 60 years on from the Cuban Missile Crisis plus, and we only have 9 nuclear weapons powers. And that's because there's been a tremendous effort to prevent other states from getting nuclear weapons. Part of that has been U.S. security guarantees, our NATO treaty, our bilateral treaty with other countries, which were premised on a tacit bargain. We will extend our nuclear umbrella over you if you forego nuclear weapons. And that was important in East Asia. And Japan, as a matter of its constitution, forswore the development of nuclear weapons. Germany, similarly, ended up not pursuing nuclear weapons, although Konrad Adenauer in the 1950s was very concerned that Germany was being singled out, singularized as not being a nuclear weapon state after Britain and France had, developed nuclear weapons. So this is a longstanding policy. And Trump is really carelessly calling it into question and casting it away, in part because he's been a very, inconstant steward of our security guarantees to other countries. He's attacked our allies. He's now launched a war against Iran that has demonstrated he's not completely capable of protecting our Gulf allies from Iranian attacks. We don't know. We'll get to that subject in a few minutes, but you know, from their point of view, he may well walk away from this, leave them to wrestle with Iran on their own, in which case they may, you know, want their own nuclear weapons. And this was a, I think, an example of what happens when you've got no process in government that will inform senior leaders of traditional policies, why they're there, the reasons for them, and the second and third order consequences of decisions you're making on the fly. And so it doesn't seem like a big deal, maybe, to a lot of people. It's a terribly big deal because the nth country problem remains. The more countries that have nuclear weapons, the more unstable a world we're going to live in, and the more likely it will be that at some point somebody will use these things in anger, which has not happened since 1945.
You know, I basically agree with everything you said and the urgency with which you said it. I suspect with regard to Trump that there, for that process part is probably in some ways the most important part of it, that these guys do not do careful diplomacy. And careful diplomacy includes knowing the history of the issue, of course, but also just how you go about drafting up agreements and stuff. I suspect also that he did not view this in the context so much of nuclear proliferation and nuclear issues in general as of the Gulf and a situation where the Saudis now find themselves, blockaded at two ends, both the Strait of Hormuz and the Bab el Mandeb. Now, the other thing I would say is, you know, on the one hand, we did have a lot of success in counterproliferation, not entirely. You know, the French still got weapons. We did lean on the Israelis pretty hard at one point, but we weren't able to prevent that. On the other hand, you know, in retrospect, when we
North
look
Korea,
at it,
Pakistan, and India.
Well, right. But, you know, successes were countries like Argentina, South Korea, Taiwan, maybe even Sweden. So,
Iraq.
Iraq, the Israelis gave us some help with that at one stage, and then we finished the job. Nuclear proliferation to responsible governments has not been such a bad thing. The problem is it doesn't stop there. But am I unhappy that there's a French or British nuclear deterrent? No. And actually, I'd like the British nuclear deterrent to be modernized in the way the French deterrent is. Not because it
Agreed.
Can substitute for us, but because it increases uncertainty on the part of the the Russians. I also think, and by the way, we've been infinitely more responsible than, say, the Russians and the Chinese, who, when you look at the history of the North Korean program, you know, they got a reactor, and it was a reactor without safeguards, which has then allowed them to proceed. And there's also there are Chinese Pakistani questions as well. What I would say, though, is part of, I think, what we're seeing is because of the unreliability of the United States as a guarantor, and sometimes, alas, even as a sworn ally, I just think we're going to see more of it. And, you know, I completely agree with, you know, the basic sentiment, and I agree we should try to slow it down, but I also think part of our responsibility people who think about these matters is to say, okay, what's that new world going to be like? Because we did buy ourselves time. We had no idea what to do with that time. And that's kind of run out. We should probably move on. I guess the first issue that I'd like to raise with you is somebody who we both knew, who just passed away. And that's Senator Lindsey Graham. And, you know, there have been very different reactions to his passing. There have been some people who said, look, he sold his soul to Trump. You know, it's a shameful degradation of a guy who was a close friend of two pretty principled politicians, Joe Lieberman and John McCain. You know, you and I both had the privilege of traveling with all three of them on more than one occasion. Then there are others who say, okay, yeah, he compromised some of his principles, but the result is he exercised some real influence on policy, particularly on Ukraine, which he had just come back from. So I'm curious, where do you fall out on that spectrum? I have my own views, but I'm curious to hear yours.
Yeah, I mean, I discussed this with our colleague Mona Charon on her show, last week. So, I mean, I think, and I'll just repeat really pretty much what I said with Mona. To me, Lindsay's really kind of a sad, tragic figure. And, I say that because you and I know from talking to, several of his Senate colleagues that they themselves saw kind of some of a psychology that, was at work within Lindsay. So first, I agree, he played a very positive role when he was part of the Three Amigos with Joe Lieberman and John McCain, traveling around the world, drawing attention to Russian aggression, drawing attention to Chinese human rights violations, drawing attention to what was going on in the civil war in Syria. I mean, there were lots of things that the three of them did together that, were praiseworthy deserve, recognition and approbation for the positive role that they played, both when George W. Bush was president, but also in particular, I would say, in opposition when Barack Obama was president. To go back to kind of Lindsay's personal kind of psychological, kind of demons, he was someone who tragically lost his father at an early age and became the head of a household. And it was, I think, palpably obvious to many of his colleagues that he was someone who was throughout his whole life in search of a proving, father figure. And when he came to the Senate, John McCain, luckily for us and for Lindsay, was that figure. But like a lot of people who are facing a family member or a spouse who is fighting a terrible disease, Lindsay did a lot of his grieving before, John McCain even had passed, and was already in the process as Senator McCain was in his final decline and sadly passing, transferring that father figure from McCain to Trump. And what drove that, I think, was Trump being slightly older than Lindsay, in a very powerful position, obviously, as president of the United States. But kind of the other driving force for Lindsay as a politician was the drive to remain relevant. I heard him say this any number of times, sitting next to him at various dinners in Washington. As a Republican member of the Senate, the only way to remain relevant, despite all of the things that Lindsay said about Trump in 2016, when Lindsay was one of the candidates running for president against Trump, all of his observations about Trump were absolutely correct. Among the observations we made in the Never Trump letter that you and I both signed in March of 2016. And it was that compulsion to be relevant that I think drove him to compromise all sorts of views. I'm sure he justified it to himself as, I'm going to be a Trump whisperer. I'm going to influence Trump. I'm going to get him to do the right thing. And he certainly tried to do that on Ukraine. He tried to do it on some other issues. But in the end, I'm not sure that the juice was worth the squeeze and all that. I'm not sure he got, what he would have hoped for out of Trump. And I think the price he will have paid is that his legacy and his reputation will end up being much diminished by the last decade of his political life.
So I think you're spot on about that quest for a father figure, and McCain really was that to him. And I think there is something to the idea that he sort of shifted some of that to Trump. I think that quest to be relevant, that's not just active politicians, but you and I both know a lot of former senior officials who, unlike the two of us, who are perfectly happy just to pick up our slingshots and try to take out windows here and there actually want to continue to play.
There's a great virtue in being irrelevant.
Yeah. Yeah, there is. It's called intellectual independence and integrity. But I guess I come out slightly differently in the end. You know, I think there were two different pieces about him, which I was very struck by. One, both by friends of ours, Ann Applebaum in The Atlantic, Brett Stevens in The New York Times, and being very critical, I think. Brett Stevens actually being much more retrospectively approving, saying, look, yeah, I took these principled stands and had absolutely no influence. He had some. Here's my take. I think it was partially rationalization, but it was partly real. I do think he moved Trump on Ukraine. I don't think that people like you and I have stepped back enough to appreciate that we have not ended up where so many Trump critics, and I don't mean the crazy ones, I mean the perfectly sane ones, thought we were going to end up with Trump ramming a truly awful deal down Ukraine's throat. And instead, we're in a much, much better place than I think most of us, very much myself included, thought we'd ever be. I think Lindsey Graham played a role in that. I also think there's a bit of a tell in that Trump's reaction to Graham's passing had the feel actually of genuine emotion and of genuine loss. And I suspect that that's somehow real. I mean, I don't want to go too far into Trump's psyche, but the things he said, the way he said it were, you know, when people asked him about who should succeed, we said, you know, it's too soon for that. I mean, he's, you know, I'm grieving about this. I think there was somewhere in there some genuine sense of loss. The way I frame it is this. I think Lindsey did what he did for the mixed motives that we've discussed. I think he achieved some of the influence that he wanted to achieve. And that's, you know, that phenomenon is not an uncommon one. The problem is you pay I don't want to sound too mystical, have a psychic or a spiritual or an ethical price for it. You sell a little piece of your soul. The fact that you sell a little piece of your soul or you lose a little piece of your soul doesn't mean that you don't accomplish anything. You know, it's not the case you sell your soul and you get nothing. He achieved something worthy of achievement, but the price was one that I think is a very, very heavy one that, you know, you and I would not be willing to pay, but other people could see the argument for paying.
Yeah, I hear that. I guess I think it's a little early to tell where we really are with Trump and Ukraine. And I'm more inclined to, I mean, Lindsey may have had some influence. I think it was pretty marginal. I think the thing that's changed Trump on Ukraine more than anything else has been Ukrainian success.
Yeah,
and
I wouldn't argue.
And that Trump, you know, he likes a winner. And, you know, right now, kind of Ukraine is, you know, more or less winning on the battlefield, which is probably a good point for us to turn to Ukraine. I mean, yep. Because there's some pretty dramatic events going on in Kyiv right now. And I wonder if you, you know, want to talk a little bit about what's gone on there, because it goes to issues of civil military affairs close to both of our hearts.
Yeah. I'll just add one little thought about Lindsey Graham in Ukraine. Trump needs to have somebody telling him that the Ukrainians are winning, because he won't know it on his own. And I suspect that that's what Graham did. So the issue in Ukraine recently is Mikhail Fedorov, the defense minister in his, I think, mid to late 30s, who had been kind of a key figure in the development of Ukrainian high tech, got into a real standoff with General Oleksandr Sirsky, age 60, who's been the commander-in-chief throughout most of the war. Zelensky resolved it by firing Fedorov. You had a series of public demonstrations. You had people, senior general officers, openly dissenting from this. Zelensky turned around and fired Sirsky, and has replaced him with a general in his early 40s named Mykhailo Drapky, who is very much of the new generation of Ukrainian generals, much more high tech, I think much more in line with Fedorov's vision, which was built around unmanned systems and so on. And it remains to be seen if it's possible that Fedorov may come back as defense minister or in some other position. So, you know, there's a lot of reaction in the press about, oh, this is terrible, that, you know, this kind of internal divisiveness and so on. And I'm not so sure. You know, my feeling is we shouldn't judge this as a civil-military relations episode against the standard of, say, the United States today. Well-established democracy, well-established norms, and all that. This is a relatively new democratic state that's been fighting this absolutely grueling war for 4 years, in which there's been an enormous amount of change. It's entirely possible that a general officer who was very effective for the first part of the war is no longer effective, among other things. I think one of the things that is often underestimated is the extent to which waging a prolonged war takes an enormous physical and psychological toll on the people who are in charge. And you know, nobody wants to admit it, nobody wants to show it, but it's profoundly true. But, you know, Sersky was the last generation that was trained by the Soviets. He was very good of that kind. He had a reputation for being insensitive to losses, which may not have been appropriate. And as I was mentioning to you in the green room, it got me thinking about a book that I reached for after my Canadian visit, including the visit to the military museum. It's by Tim Cook, who unfortunately died young this past year, who'd been the chief historian of the Canadian War Museum. It's called The Madman and the Butcher. And it's about the standoff between Sam Hughes, who was the equivalent of a minister of defense for Canada during World War I, and Arthur Currie, who's the commanding general on the Western Front, who took enormous casualties, and hence the nickname The Butcher. And Hughes, who was perhaps certifiably crazy, who was called a madman. And their disputes were public, very controversial. Hughes got the worst of it. And I was just looking as I was looking at the conclusion, you know, one of the things Cook says is, you know, the personal relationships were very complicated. The personalities were complicated. Contemporaries made sweeping judgments at the time. Historians, usually against Hughes in favor of Currie, although that changes as the full weight of the losses sunk in. And by the way, Canada was taking per capita far heavier losses than we took during either World War. People sometimes forget that. And he said, you know, the historians sometimes have fallen for that as well. In truth, everything depends on context, and we shouldn't be that surprised. And one of the thoughts that occurred to me is, you know, Canada had been an independent country, sort of, for about 50 years, not more than that. And in some ways, independence wasn't really fully consolidated until towards the end of the 19th century. So I guess my feeling is this is, on the one hand, I can understand why people get upset. It's not clear to me it's the worst outcome. It's not clear to me that this is simply a case of villains and heroes, or competence and incompetence, or butchers and techno freaks, or anything remotely like that. I think it's the way I'm thinking about it is it's a reminder to be very careful when you look at the news of something like that happening, to say, okay, what's the context here? And to be sensitive to some of the subtleties and nuances. So that's my take.
Yeah, I largely agree with that. I guess I would say a couple of things. One, when Fedorov was first fired and Sersky was left in place, there was a joke making the rounds that, you know, Soviet-era generals on both sides were extremely pleased, you know, because there was a bit of commentary on Russian telegram channels, you know, saying, aha, great. I would go maybe a little further than you would, which is, I think we may be getting actually the best possible outcome from what was a pretty messy situation, both because the new commander comes, you know, with a a pretty good reputation and a lot of experience on the battlefield. I think it is probably true that even though, as you say, Sirski was faulted for taking a lot of losses, the reality is that, you know, the success they've had on the battlefield is probably a lot of Fedorov, but some of Sirski as well. I think both contributed to it. But the big takeaway for me is that there's been a stream of criticism, particularly in the sort of right wing of the Republican Party, about Ukraine being a dictatorship and Zelensky being a dictator because elections have been suspended during wartime, because the country's under a state of emergency and the Constitution says you can't have elections when the country's under a state of emergency for obvious reasons. But he's governing essentially kind of ex cathedra, et cetera. I mean, J.D. Vance has made this kind of critique. What you saw in this episode was in contrast to Russia, where Putin is a dictator and makes all the decisions, and is happy to send people off to their deaths in, you know, enormous numbers, was a huge upswelling of a very active civil society, not just demonstrations in Kyiv, but across the country. And that Zelensky had to take into account, you know, a huge, you know, outcry of public opinion. And one, I mean, Zelensky's got many very good qualities, you know, as a war leader. One of his less good qualities is that he's very paranoid about potential future, you know, rivals. I mean, that's how General Zaluzhny, the first, you know, commander, you know, unfortunately, fell out of favor with Zelensky because he looked like he might be emerging as a rival. Same was true of Fedorov. But even with all of that, he's been forced to now try and either give Fedorov some, you know, some other position, although it appears that Fedorov will only accept being Minister of Defense. So we don't know how it will all work out. But it could end up being the best of all possible outcomes, everything considered. And one final observation, Laura Loomer, of all people, has been in Ukraine.
Yes.
And I mean, to our point earlier in our conversation about Trump's changing point of view on Ukraine, and despite all of her earlier criticisms of Ukraine of the variety that I described, she's recanting all of that in real time and talking about, you know, what's happening in Ukraine and the heroism of the Ukrainian people and standing up to Russia, et cetera. And I think that may mark a real shifting point in how some of the MAGA right is thinking about Ukraine, which is, you know, all to the good.
You know, I there's something chilling about the idea that the big turning point in the Ukraine war is when Laura Loomer sees the light. I mean, it's but that's the world we're in. So actually, speaking of civil-military relations, maybe we could move to a somewhat related subject, maybe talking about somebody else who may have been overly shaped by their early experiences. That's Pete Hegseth, showing up on Capitol Hill, not getting such a great reception when he asked for a supplemental to cover the costs of the Iran war. I know that's one that you've been following very closely, and I'd like to hear what your view of that, because it sounded to me like he got fairly roughly handled, pretty roughly. There's also the question of, you know, which you and I have talked about before, but we may want to revisit. You know, to what extent should General Kane, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, is it okay for him to dodge certain questions on the grounds that, hey, that's a political decision? And to what extent does he really have to say, now our strategy is this, or something along those lines? So why don't you have at it?
Well, first of all, Hegseth got beat up on, I would say, on a bipartisan basis. And I think this is a real, you know, a huge problem for the administration, because the president has been threatening and said today in a Truth Social post, and we're recording on Thursday, that he's on the cusp of making a decision about whether he's going to go forward with a big, massive escalation of the war. Yeah, and or you know, continue to try and get the Iranians back to the negotiating table and go back to the MOU and the ceasefire and the mediators, the Pakistanis and the Qataris, have been talking about a 10-day ceasefire to get people back talking and get back to kind of status quo ante July 9th when the latest kind of round kicked off again. I think the president's running up into, you know, problems of physics because the Department of Defense is actually running out of money. I mean, because they don't have, you know, appropriations right now. They're frantically moving around money, including, you know, taking money that is for, you know, veteran, you know, people being assessed for their veterans benefits. That's, you know, some of that money for that is being taken away to go to operations as they desperately try to keep operating. We've talked on this show for several years about the defense industrial base and the shortage of munitions, and CSIS, where you sit, has done a lot of very good work on how much we've depleted our munitions and how difficult it is to replenish all this. And he's begging for money. I mean, so the president might threaten a big, horrible, you know, escalation to scare the Iranians, but the Iranians are, if anything, follow U.S. politics more closely than most American citizens do. And they're very well aware of all these limitations. And I'm not sure the president's threats, which include, by the way, explicit threats that we should commit acts that would be war crimes, you know, attacking civilian infrastructure with no dual, use, yeah, et cetera.
Although just on that one, my impression is just about everything is dual use. I mean, a good lawyer will construct that case. I would point out, by the way, the Ukrainians have now begun attacking the Russian equivalent of Amazon on the grounds that there's lots of stuff that gets shipped to Russian soldiers, which is true.
Right.
So the war crime stuff is for me, the real line that you cross is when you are deliberately killing civilians. About obliterating a civilization, you know, that I think is it. Blowing up bridges, I mean, or even power plants.
When the Secretary of State says that, you know, the Iranians are saying an eye for an eye, but President Trump is saying, a head for an eye, that actually speaks to a disproportion of force that starts to get you into kind of, I think, very tricky territory.
What happened was Foreign Minister Araghchi said the Iranians will do an eye for an eye. And Rubio said, well, I'm working for a guy who believes in a head for an eye. I will remind you of our old friend and mentor, Al Bernstein, who it was actually quite famous at the Naval War College because, you know, people would talk about a tooth for a tooth, and Al's motto was an eye for a tooth. Which was, right. And the truth is, and here I'm about to go a little bit dark.
Al was not the Secretary of State.
He wasn't the Secretary of State
at the time.
It's two things. First, it's a better way of talking to the Iranians than the way we usually talk to the Iranians. I mean, it's a better way of talking to them than Jake Sullivan, who's been recanting a whole bunch of things, talk to them. I mean, they need to understand that they're dealing with somebody who might be quite ferocious. And secondly, some of the talk of proportionality, I think, is totally misplaced. I don't actually believe in completely proportional responses to, you know, various kinds of mayhem. And so
I take all those points.
Gave a little cheer for Marco Rubio.
So I take all those points, but let me make one counter, which is, as you pointed out, the president's been threatening to exterminate them as a civilization.
Yes, no, that's not okay.
And the like multiple times and has not followed through. I mean, the Iranians are discounting all of this heavily. And, you know, it's not clear to me, based on what we have in the theater right now, that we could actually do what the president is suggesting. The president said, we are going to have operations at a level above what we did at the peak of Epic Fury when we were striking, had, you know, 500 to 600 air and missile strikes a day. But right now, what we've moved is a lot of fighter aircraft, which have a lot of strike capability, F-35, F-16, F-15. We've got B-1 bombers flying from Fairford. They just flew a strike for the first time the other night. But most, I think they've flown a few B-52s back, but most of them went back to CONUS after the ceasefire. And the B-2s are all, you know, bedded down in CONUS. And I don't know that right now, without moving a lot of stuff forward to the theater, that we have the capability of executing what he's saying, particularly with the munitions shortages, for missile strikes. So, I just worry that he's in a business of making threats he won't deliver on, which I think is the worst of all possible worlds.
That he doesn't do that, that you're right. I mean, he makes threats he doesn't follow through on, although he's followed through on more. If you remember last time I said, I'll eat crow, then I said, okay, I don't have to really eat crow. I have to eat crow tatar. Now I'm beginning to think it's just more like a little bit of crow pate.
A little appetizer.
On a cracker. I think one thing that has probably surprised the Iranians and certainly surprised a lot of people here is he is more resolute. He has been more resolute on this than I would have expected, at least. The more significant movement, by the way, was I saw a report that we've moved 150 medical personnel to Landstuhl, which is the main military hospital in Germany, which is really the focal point for dealing with casualties in Iraq and Afghanistan. And that makes me think that one thing that they may be willing to be thinking about, whether it's a good idea or a bad idea, I don't comment because I don't know, would be something perhaps to seize some of the islands.
Off ground operation.
Right. There's one. Go ahead.
I know you want to go to Pickaxe Mountain, and I'll go there in a second. Just to tie this part off, though, one of the things that struck me about the movement to Landstuhl and all this discussion about, you know, seizing Kashim, seizing Karg, maybe the Tombs or whatever, this war, if you're looking at the polling, started out at historically low levels of support and has just dropped since it started on March 1st, in part because the president has not made a coherent argument to the American people about why we should be doing this, what his objectives are, and how he intends to achieve them. And he had an opportunity last Thursday night, and he squandered it by talking about all this nonsense about elections. And if you look at the polling, the support for the war has dropped by about 10 to 15 points, depending on what poll you're looking at, from a historically low level of support to begin with. How do you think it's going to go if we start doing stuff where we start taking, I mean, I don't want to suggest that the casualties we've taken already, some 430 wounded, 18 killed, are insignificant. But what if we start taking much larger numbers of casualties? How is he going to sustain this politically? I have no idea.
I agree with that. I mean, this has been an utterly incompetently conceived and executed war, which is one of the reasons why I will not make the case for doing it. But I don't make the case against it because I think the alternatives are actually pretty bad also. The only thing that would qualify that is, and this is one of those few cases where I think political science has actually delivered a finding that's verifiable, is Americans support successful wars. They oppose unsuccessful wars. If, you know, now this would be a fantasy because I don't think it's going to happen. If we woke up tomorrow and the regime had collapsed, or, you know, we get a deal that actually is a good deal rather than the truly awful deal that J.D. Vance negotiated and is now running away from, it would be different. Now, but the problem is that's not very likely. I mean, I do think he's kind of boxed in at the moment, but I'm not sure that he's simply, you know, a lot of people said he's just going to run away from it. On the evidence of his past behavior, I'm not willing to bet on it.
Which brings us to Pickaxe Mountain, which you wanted to talk about. So the president has said, "We're going to hit Pickaxe Mountain." He said it twice. We're going to hit him really hard soon.
First, to kind of build this up for our audience. First thing, Pickaxe Mountain is this big mountain, and like a couple hundred feet under the mountain, there is some kind of facility. point A,
under construction,
which had been under construction for some time. Point B, there's a report, Israeli intelligence said the Iranians have been busily moving centrifuges there. Okay. So what I'd like to hear from you is first, how do you evaluate the report of Israeli intelligence? And secondly, how do you think about Pickaxe Mountain?
Sure. So let me start with the president's threat, and then I'll move to the intelligence. The president's threat, I think, was triggered by the Israeli intelligence, in part because the president has, you know, staked everything in this war on Iran can't have a nuclear weapon, which is somewhat in tension with his earlier statements that the Operation Midnight Hammer in June of 2025
obliterated
the Iranian nuclear program. There's a part of me that would like to think that if Donald Trump were kind of normal president, this would be a feint, and that what he's trying to do is draw a lot of the limited air and missile defense assets that Iran has to Pickaxe Mountain, because we've got some other target that is the real center of gravity of the Iranian effort, and that's what we're really going to hit. But I don't think that's the way Donald Trump works.
You know, that's so I have to say that the meme here is that great Saturday Night Live skit about Ronald Reagan, where, you know, a bunch of Girl Scouts come and says, "Hello, girl, little girl." Door closes, and all of a sudden he's this laser focused, on top of it kind of guy. That's, yeah, we would like Trump to be the second guy, but he's not.
He's not. So, I don't know the basis of the Israeli intelligence. If I were in the U.S. government right now, I would be interrogating that intelligence very carefully. The current Israeli government, and unfortunately the current head of the Mossad, is a political appointee of Netanyahu's, both of whom have an axe to grind here, which is to keep this going and keep the president engaged in the war. They don't want him to walk away from the war. And they've got good and sufficient reasons for that, but that's a bias that they bring to this. We know from open source intelligence, the work that David Albright and others have done, that there's been vehicular traffic at Pickaxe Mountain. But David Albright's made the point that while Pickaxe needs to be dealt with in some way, preferably by getting the IAEA in there to examine the site, because there's so much we don't know about it, more that we don't know, he's made the point that, look, this is not a site where they're going to actually be able to enrich uranium because they don't have the spare parts for centrifuges. They may be trying to move some centrifuges for storage area. We don't really know, but I would love to know, more about it. I think that there's a tendency to say, well, it's, as you said, it's a 1,600 foot above or 1,600 meter above sea level mountain, and the facilities built, 100 meters below the mountain, and it goes down. We don't know how deep it is, how many levels there are, and therefore maybe it's beyond the reach of our best ordnance, which is the GBU-57 massive ordnance penetrator. I'm not persuaded of that. I think the intelligence community may know some things that would allow them to use the MOP. There are also some tactics, techniques, and procedures. You could use this weapon even if you don't know all the schematics of it. So I think it's possible that you could attack it. And maybe the president's going to attack it and then declare victory and say, I've obliterated their nuclear program again, and walk away, which might be the best outcome here, frankly. Although I think the bottom line is we're not getting out of this without the Iranians controlling the Strait of Hormuz, which is a huge problem.
Yeah, that's the thing. For a moment to the Israeli intelligence, Pickaxe Mountain, and then maybe wrap up on Iran. I think whenever you get foreign intelligence, the first question that you're going to ask is, are people trying to manipulate us? You and I both remember a major episode that we spent a lot of time on, where some of the initial intelligence came from a foreign source, and there was an enormous amount of skepticism that it was a foreign government trying to manipulate us, and it turned out not to be so. And the truth is, foreign governments, you know, sometimes they're just not very good. I think we might want to think back on the curveball intelligence from the Germans about the Iraqi program. Sometimes they are right, and we're not inclined to listen. But I think that the main point that I would just, you know, urge on all our viewers, whenever you see a report in the newspapers that, you know, intelligence has discovered X, Y, and Z, that, you know, it benefits somebody to have leaked this. And no matter, and even if something has not been leaked, you always have to interrogate it. I mean, that's the obligation of any policymaker, of any observer, is never to take any of this stuff as gospel. On the Strait of Hormuz,
I agree completely.
You know, what strikes me is that even people like David Ignatius, who are usually fairly dovish, I think, have been saying, look, what we ought to do is just maintain this blockade on the Iranians because it's not acceptable in the long run for them to have some control of the strait. And I'm actually more inclined to think that we're going to end up with something like that. Now, could be at the price of a lot of damage. I think the Iranians are afraid of that. That's one of the reasons why they've unleashed the Houthis.
I agree with that. But I think where this may be going is, so the Iranians want to get back to the MOU and their interpretation of it, which is that they get to control the strait, which frankly is a pretty fair reading of the language as it stands. I know that the Americans believe there were side deals and that they have a different interpretation, but if you just read the language in English of Article 5 of the 14-point MOU, it pretty much says Iran is in charge of the strait. That's what they want to get back to. So my suspicion is no matter where this goes, whether we end up with some escalation for a period of time, which I think will be limited by the physics, as we said earlier, and the money, or whether we get back to sooner rather than later to a 10-day ceasefire and we're back discussing these things, we're likely to see a continuation of this for some time. That is to say, this, you know, contestation over who controls the strait, with the Iranians periodically, you know, hitting ships, and we're periodically hitting their coastline. I was struck by a comment by our former colleague Mark Montgomery, who was policy director of the SASC, but a retired Navy Rear Admiral, saying it would take weeks of operations at the level that we've been seeing for the last 12 days before you could even start to think about escort operations. You know, and I think even that may be optimistic.
Right. And you and I discussed anyway the limitations on our ability to do escort because of building decisions we made. We're running out of time.
And there's so much more to talk about. Where did the $13 billion that the United States has taken to Venezuelan oil, where'd the money go? Are we going to actually go into Mali to replace the Russians who replaced the French to deal with Al-Qaeda there, all of whom have failed? A lot to talk about.